Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica stations KPFA in Berkeley and WBAI in New York City, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. This newscast was produced by Aaron Glantz, headlines editor Randy Zimmerman, technical producer Jade Paget-Seekins. We had web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. I'm Deepa Fernandez.
I'm Rachel Maher in Melbourne, Australia. Free Speech Radio News is a vital part of global media activism, creating an alternative news network that strengthens and sustains the international movement for social justice. This broadcast only stays on air with your financial support. Please donate to Free Speech Radio News online at www.fsrn.org. That's
And this is radio station WBAI New York, where it's 7:01, time for Off the Hook.
Good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Manuel Goldstein here with you on this third day of July. The date is getting dangerously close. Yeah, it's going to be in just about a week and a couple of days. The H2K2 conference will be upon us. Upon us like some kind of invading army, I suppose. And Rob is here all the way from Amsterdam. Greetings.
Hey there.
How you doing?
Well, hanging in there.
Yeah.
It's hot.
It's very hot. I'm sorry about that. And it's not something that was supposed to happen. But fortunately, the way I'm looking at it is that if it's happening now, it won't be happening during the conference. So that's something to... it'll be raining, probably. Well, all kinds of other things will be happening. But you just came from the Ruckus camp out there in California, correct?
That was fun, yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting people. Good people working on all sorts of different projects, realizing they need technology, are already using technology. Everybody know what the Ruckus thing is?
Well, why don't you tell us quickly?
It's the Ruckus Society organizes trainings for activists, nonviolent protest methods of all kinds, and they did a special action camp a whole week which dealt with technology and how activists could use technology better, both in communicating among themselves and communicating with the world, how you can use websites effectively, how you can use the internet, just all sorts of fun stuff.
Mm-hmm. And there'll be a report from Ruckus at H2K2 as well, where we basically update people who didn't make it to the Ruckus camp on what kinds of things were talked about there and what kinds of progress was made. It is an historical event. I mean, you were one of how many people at this thing?
I guess about 100, uh-huh. 80 to 100. It sort of differed over the days. There was busier and less busy days.
And Mike, who's usually on this program, was at. He's being held over, I believe, for questioning by the people over there. But once they release him, he'll be back here, I believe, next week. And he'll have stories to tell about that as well. So, yeah, the Ruckus Camp drew all kinds of people. I wanted to go to it myself, but, you know, this conference thing has been taking all my time. I mean, it's unbelievable, but it feels great. It really feels like we're bringing people together at this thing. We have over 70 panels. I mean, you know, only 8 years ago we did the First Hope. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
The chaos that that entailed, also at the Hotel Pennsylvania. And just to have 2 days' worth of a single track was something beyond what we had ever planned. And now we have 70 different panels of speakers, a network room that's something like 35,000 square feet, and just unbelievable expectations as to what's going to be happening. So pre-registration is closed. You can no longer buy tickets to this thing on the internet. You'll have to go to the door. You'll be able to go to the door, which is on 7th Avenue, right on 7th Avenue, between 32nd and 33rd Street. It's called the Hotel Pennsylvania Pavilion. And you'll be able to go there on Thursday, the day before the conference. That way you don't have to wait on long lines that rival, you know, Knicks playoff ticket lines across the street at Madison Square Garden. You know, it's this way. We've learned a lot from about crowd control, about funneling crowds. Remember that first year in 1994 when basically, yeah, you were there too, Jim, weren't you?
Yeah, I was.
Yeah, we were all. Actually, AutoCheck, you weren't there.
I was not there.
Yeah.
No.
Well,
unfortunately.
Well, three out of the four people in this room were there. And that very first day, I believe we started. We didn't start till 12 noon on Saturday. To give you an idea, we had a single track. We started at 12 noon on Saturday. This time, we're starting at 10 o'clock on Friday, 10 o'clock in the morning, and we have three different tracks of speakers. And
I've seen the program. It's quite an impressive lineup you got there.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. It really is. A lot of hard work has gone into this thing by many, many people. The organization, I think, is just it's taken off so tremendously in the past decade, and I think a lot of it is inspired by what you guys did over in Holland with all of the conferences, HIP, HAL, Galactic Hacker Party, just to see what people can do if they get together. It's really awe-inspiring. I don't think we'd be having any of these things were it not for you guys. So, but you need help, right? You have to come up with a clever name for the next one.
Yes, in 2005.
2005. Well, we've gone through what? We've gone through GHP for Galactic Hacker Party. We've gone through
Hacking at the End of the Universe.
HEU.
Hacking in Progress.
Hacking in Progress, HIP.
Hackers at Large.
HAL 2001. That was, I don't know. Are there any more good names? 2005? We'll have to think about that. And I believe next year in Germany there's going to be another Chaos Camp. So we'll keep people updated on that.
How about Hackers Are Here? Ha!
Hey, that's good,
isn't
it?
That's good.
I like that. That's very good, AutoJack.
I've been thinking about this for about a day now.
Hackers Are Here. Or Hackers Are There. Hat.
Hat, yeah.
Okay, well, whatever. We'll come up with something. I'm sure the BAI listeners will help us out as well. What else has been going on? I'm sorry?
You can win a car.
You could win a car. You won't win it from us, but you could win a car. That's for sure. It's July 3rd, and you know what that means. Yes, kids, it's time for Reagan Death Watch again. Remember this?
Yes.
Last year? Now, Jim, actually, it's good that you're here because I didn't bring my almanac, and you're a walking almanac, so it actually helps to have the facts that you might have here handy. But basically, what the Reagan Death Watch is, and, you know, I've been told that, you know, maybe that's a little bit disrespectful to have it phrased that way, so maybe we'll call it the Reagan Death Challenge this year, where we're challenging...
That sounds even worse. Well, it sounds like you're encouraging Squeaky Fromm and Sarah Jane Moore and...
No, they were only after
Ford. Oh, they were after Ford.
They were after Ford. Nobody
Hinckley.
Was after, Hinckley was after Reagan.
Just leave it alone.
All we need to do is to get Reagan through the next day, and he can beat the curse. Now, the curse, as you well know, is that every president elected in a year ending in zero has either died in office or has died on July 4th. Now, we're not going to go over the history like we did last year because, you know, we went over every single president last year and we found, yes, indeed, this is true. So if you want to argue about it, go look in an almanac and argue with the almanac. So basically, Reagan obviously did not die in office. And in order to break this curse, he must not die on July 4th. Tomorrow being July 4th, we all have to, you know, hope that Reagan does not...
It doesn't have to be this July 4th.
It doesn't have to be. That's right. That's the thing. Every
year...
Well,
we watch to make sure that it doesn't happen.
Right. That's mm-hmm. the death watch.
Now, there's a lot of confusion. And again, to clear this up from last year, what time does the Reagan death watch start? Does it, I mean, right now it's midnight in parts of Europe.
is it proper to have the Reagan Death Watch start then? The answer is no, it is not. The Reagan Death Watch starts at midnight in the time zone that he is in. So unless Reagan is in your time zone, Elver there, and I don't think he is. I think he's in California and will be all the time now. It does not start until 3 a.m. New York time, 12 midnight California time, and it continues for 24 hours until July 5th has broken on that particular time zone.
Right, and on the off chance that he travels to some other time zone, of course, it would extend.
Yeah, well, he would have to travel on July 4th to do that.
Right, right.
And I think, you know, he knows well enough not to do that. And again, a lot of people also are concerned that, hey, every president in a year elected ending in zero, George W. Bush, 2000, no, he does not have to worry. He was not actually elected there.
All right.
So this is one time where...
And as the token Republican here, I protest.
What are you saying? What are you saying here? You want him to die in office
elected.
Or on July 4th?
No, he was elected.
Horrible thing to say. I'm trying to protect him here.
Yeah, sure.
He could die, though.
Well, that's true. Anything's possible. This is probably not appropriate conversation to be having July 4th. Everybody's all paranoid about terrorist activity in New York City on the 4th of July. Right. Rob, what do you think about this? You come here from Europe, and we're all in a tizzy over here with all kinds of crazy predictions and security precautions and all that kind of thing.
You sure go through a lot of security inspections and stuff on airports, and I'm always wondering what part of the procedure that I've just undergone could Mohammed Atta not have passed?
Yeah, I know. It's really silly because none of this would have prevented anything. It just makes us all the more edgy.
Well, it solves the airline's problem of reselling tickets, and it solves a bunch of problems, but not the ones they say they're solving.
Mm-hmm. Let me just interject that one of your pet peeves is not the right word, but New York is on a slightly higher color code than the rest of the country.
What, they changed the color? They took it down. If you go to the White House, if you go to the White House website, the page that has the color codes for the state of alert or whatever, that page is gone. They took it down. Someone must have given them a copy of one of our shows where we're making fun of it or something, and they don't want that there anymore. So that's another way we don't know what color it is right now.
Yesterday, I believe it was Mayor Bloomberg got on air and said we're at orange.
Does Mayor Bloomberg have the right to say what color we are? I mean, well, color is a national thing. It's not a local thing.
Well, I would think it would be a local thing. I think there's probably a lot more danger of a terrorist attack in New York than in wheat fields in Nebraska.
Okay, fine. I live in a small town. Can I make my color red if I feel like it? I mean, if I feel particularly endangered, can I say, okay, it's a red day today? I don't think it works that way. I thought it was a national thing.
Well, if you're a security official, elected official, you know, public safety, something like that, maybe you can.
I think Mayor Bloomberg may have acted out of turn there, and perhaps we should report this to the federal agency in charge of colors. All right, whatever. World Cup is over. What a great event that was. Autojack and I, we were watching it nonstop. Yeah. And yeah. I got to say, though, I was reading. This actually was on Slashdot, of all places. They were talking about how the World Cup was viewed in various parts of the world. And without exception, in the United States, people were complaining that they just would not shut up talking on while the game was going on, and that they cut away. During the last game, they cut away. They did not show the emotional ceremony with the winning of the World Cup with the Brazilians. They just showed more commercials.
The raining cranes or whatever.
It was so sad because we saw it on Canadian TV. We saw the CBC, which deferred to the BBC, and that's the way to see something like this. You feel like you're watching public television. It's not a sporting event. It's kind of like something interesting and educational almost. I know it sounds like a reach, but it really felt that way. And just seeing all the different cultures, the different kinds of people getting together, the harmony and the camaraderie, it was a really, really good thing. I'm very happy I saw it. Congratulations to everybody involved. And one post note that a lot of people might not be aware of, the tiny Himalayan kingdom of Bhutan got 3 goals from its captain to beat visiting Montserrat 4-0 in a game for the title of world's worst team. That's right, the world's worst team. Wangyel Dorjai recovered from an eye infection to become the hero in the matchup billed as the other final, which took place hours before Brazil beat Germany in the World Cup final. Bhutan came out of isolation in 2000 to become the youngest member of FIFA, World Soccer's governing body. FIFA ranked the team number 202, just ahead of last place Montserrat. And the game was conceived by a Dutch communications firm, Rob. So, that's a pretty good idea. The having the worst two teams play in a final, I think that's
That sums up the spirit right there. Really pretty cool. Yes, anyway, we have special guests with us on the telephone. We have joining us two of our legal representatives, Eric Grimm from Michigan, who have represented us in the Ford case. Eric, you there?
I am here.
And Robin Gross of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who helped represent us in the ECSS case 2 years ago. Robin, are you there?
I'm here.
Great. Well, we've had developments on both of these cases in the last week. Let's start with the good news first, or the better news, I guess. And that would be the Ford case, where the Ford Motor Company officially dropped their challenge, their appeal, to the decision that was reached against them last December. That decision allowed us, 2600 Magazine, to link the site with the word we cannot say over the air, followed by GeneralMotors.com. We linked that site to Ford.com. They didn't like that. They sued us. They didn't even ask us to move it or point to someplace else. They just brought us into court hoping for a precedent of some sort. And, Eric, what is it, in fact, that actually happened?
Ford first filed an appeal. We also had an attorney's fees petition pending with the trial court, which was denied, so we filed a cross appeal. And what happened is that Ford conceded their loss in the case, and 2600 made a decision about whether to pursue the cross appeal, and both parties simultaneously dismissed the whole proceeding, meaning that everything that Judge Cleland decided in the trial court stands exactly as it was decided, which means that even if you assume that every single allegation in Ford's complaint is true, Judge Cleland has decided that no court in America can do anything about it.
Now, Ford had vowed to pursue this, to appeal the decision that Judge Kaplan had decided on.
Not Kaplan, Cleland.
I'm sorry, Cleland, Kaplan. Too many judges in my life.
Right.
Okay. So basically,
if I had to choose between the two, I don't know which I'd choose.
Well, I have to tell you, when I was there in Detroit, it seemed like Judge Cleland was listening to us.
Yes, he was.
I never got that feeling from Judge Kaplan. I just never got that. It seemed like he just was angry that we were even wasting his time. And maybe Robin can tell us a little bit more about that. But as far as the significance,
I've actually dealt with both judges. Cleland, in terms of his demeanor on the bench, I think is a much more receptive and a more courteous fellow. But in terms of their worldview and ideology, I'm not sure if you get any advantage from being in front of Cleland versus Judge Kaplan.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, we are fortunate that he ruled in our favor in this, because I think it sets a precedent let's put it this way. If it had gone the other way, the precedent would have been devastating. I mean, what do you think it would have meant as far as the average web user?
We would have had to see what happened in future cases, but it would have been essentially the first case to provide very powerful ammunition for something that a lot of big companies have been looking for. And whenever I go to continuing legal education conferences right now, the one thing that a lot of corporate clients are asking their big law firm attorneys is, how can you enable us to use trademark law to shut down the cyber gripers? We don't want the truth to get out. We're very comfortable with the old situation in which, in order to get a message to a large number of people, you had to go through television, which meant that any given customer just simply couldn't access an audience. Now the Internet has changed that completely, and a lot of companies would like to use the law to shut down the small, what they view as annoying or possibly even damaging, person who tells the truth about their company. And if Ford had won this case, that would have been essentially the first arrow in their quiver that they would have used to build on in order to start shutting down dissenters.
And it makes sense that they would go after us first, because in the eyes of most people, we're probably not important enough to defend Perhaps what we say is distasteful to some people's ears, but I think there's a danger there if you dismiss people because you don't agree with them, because you think they're a fringe element of some sort, because that's the first step that's taken. And after that, they will take a bigger chunk and silence even more people.
Right. Well, Emmanuel, you are exactly the kind of defendant symbolically that a company like Ford or that the recording industry or the motion picture industry looks at as ideal to have as a defendant in one of these cases, because especially when you're dealing with a former prosecutor like Judge Cleland, who tends to come at things from a law and order focus, you're exactly the kind of person that he doesn't want to rule in favor of. And that creates a likelihood, at least in the minds of Ford and some other plaintiffs, of their getting their way and making some bad law through careful selection of who the defendant is.
Now, that careful selection, of course, was the whole basis for the DECSS case, which pitted us against, pretty much all of Hollywood. The first test of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the much-hated DMCA, back in 2000, we were sued by the Motion Picture Association of America for daring to print the source code for the DECSS program, which allows people to decrypt DVDs. Is that the proper way to say it? It was widely misreported in the press as a pirating tool, a way of copying DVDs. That's not what it ever was. It basically allowed you to transport the capabilities of a DVD player to a Linux machine, for instance, a non-supported operating system. That's right. They're making it so that you have to run a certified operating system in order to be able to play a DVD on your computer. What the ECSS did was allow you to bypass that and put control back in the hands of the consumer, meaning that they were able to buy a DVD and buy an operating system and buy a computer and make it all work together. That's really what it was all about. It had nothing to do with piracy. However, the press just did not see that or did not want to see that. That's what we were fighting against as far as getting the story reported. It was very difficult. It was very challenging. But we managed to do it with the help of resources like WBAI, 2600 meetings, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, of course, and all kinds of people who had clues about what it was that was really going on. So now, 2.5 years later, after 2.5 years after we initially got sued by the MPAA, it's a very different world. It's a world where people know what the DMCA is. It's a world where people are educated about the threats that are facing them from such organizations as the Recording Industry of America and the Motion Picture Association of America, among others. So with all that in mind, that is where we came to the decision that we announced today, that we are not going to be pursuing the appeal of the DECSS case to the Supreme Court. Reason being that there is a very, very, very slim chance that the Supreme Court would even agree to hear the case in the first place. And them deciding not to hear the case, that's a setback right there. Then, if they did agree to hear the case, 1 in 100 chance maybe, if they agree to hear the case, the odds of them actually ruling in our favor are even smaller. And that would be a setback as well. See, the thing is, we are, I guess, the targeted group here. We are defendants that the other side likes to have because the judicial system is kind of prejudiced against us, which they're really not supposed to be, but they are. There are many other people right now fighting this fight. We have Dmitry Skirov, who was prosecuted, jailed, in fact, by for a violation of the DMCA. And there's many other cases that are pending, and I'm sure many others will be happening in the next few years. It's a changed environment, and in that way, I think we come out of this a lot stronger, and I think that it's the right decision to make. Now, Robin Gross from the EFF is with us, too, and maybe you could go into a little bit more detail as to just what this decision actually means.
Well, this decision was hard fought, and we, as you well know, we went back and forth, and we weighed the pros and the cons, and ultimately decided, as you stated, the Supreme Court is very unlikely to take this case. For one thing, this is really the only appellate court decision that has been issued about the DMCA's anti-circumvention provisions. So we don't really have a split in the circuits, and which is often a necessary thing before the Supreme Court is willing to take a look at a case, is for there to be different parts of the country that have come up with different rules, and the Supreme Court will come in and try to establish a uniform national rule. And it's still pretty early in the enforcement of the DMCA. We've only got this one Second Circuit ruling. So the chances of the Supreme Court taking it are extremely rare. And quite frankly, we feel that if they did take it, these would not be the best facts to present to the court to help them to see a lot of the problems that have come out since the DMCA was passed. And it's, we want to win. We want to get the DMCA's anti-circumvention provisions repealed. And if this is not the best vehicle to do that, then we'll find the best vehicle that is. And we'll bring another case to the Supreme Court that will be successful in overturning the statute.
Now, was this, in fact, not the case when we launched the case in the first place, when we decided to fight the initial court case, when we decided to appeal? Was it right to stay in it at that point?
I think it was. I think we did a real job of educating this country and really the world about what the Digital Millennium Copyright Act is and why it's a problem. And although we were not terribly successful at the Court of Appeals in getting the DMCA overturned, we did come up with some legal rulings in that decision that are very helpful to society. There's the Second Circuit Court of Appeals found that computer code is creative expression worthy of First Amendment protection, and that falls right in line with a lot of the other cases that we've brought in this realm. And so that's a really important ruling for the Second Circuit to have made and to have recognized. But we don't want to lose that ruling. We don't want to push too hard and ask for too much too soon. So I think what we've done to this point has been the right thing. We have fought this battle. We have educated people about the problems of the DMCA, but we're going to bring a different set of facts before the Supreme Court to actually have it repealed.
Now,
Emmanuel?
Yes, go ahead.
I'd just like to say that I agree with Robin 100% on that, that EFF did exactly the right thing, precisely because when you look at Judge Kaplan's ruling, it had a lot of rough edges on it, and I think that the Second Circuit decision was important. We didn't get everything our perspective wants to get out of that. But nevertheless, it definitely did remove some of those rough edges on Judge Kaplan's decision. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with the Electronic Frontier Foundation and other people who are fighting for freedom to use essentially the same strategy that the recording industry and the motion picture industry have been using, and make sure that we set up the cases so that it's a very favorable fact pattern for the positions that we're trying to argue in front of court, instead of letting the motion picture industry decide what battleground we're going to fight on. So I think that the EFF has done exactly the right thing by taking the appeal to this point and waiting for a little while for the next case and a better case to take it up to the Supreme Court.
And one thing that really impressed me over the course of this entire thing is just the number of people that have come together. I mean, apart from the legal finesse of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the Garbus firm, Kathleen Sullivan, there have been so many people that have just come to us from the open source community, the Linux world, the hacker world, and even people in mainstream America that actually somehow, despite the opposition of the mass media, were able to get it, were able to understand. The people that, you know, we handed leaflets out to in front of movie theaters, the people that that really tried to understand what it was all about and realized that they weren't being told the entire story. That, to me, is the success that we can celebrate as far as getting to this stage. And Robin, perhaps you could tell us, I said there are other cases that will be happening. What do you envision as far as how many cases involving the DMCA will be on the horizon?
Well, I expect a lot. I mean, you know, a lot of folks like to joke around and call the DMCA the Copyright Lawyers Full Employment Act. So we're going to see a lot of DMCA cases brought. We are particularly looking for cases that will be very sympathetic with the public, both with the legal issues and with the not so legal issues, the more public relations kinds of aspects. Because the reality is these cases are very often won and lost in the public's minds, in the press, and you know, the judges, they read the newspapers, and they're not immune to the pulse of how the country is feeling about these issues. Well, take for example the case that we brought last summer regarding the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. There was the threat that went out to Professor Felton and his research team when they wanted to publish the vulnerabilities of the SDMI technology, which would control digital music use. And these are the kind of facts that we want to bring out where we've got a group of scientists, university professors who are receiving threats from the recording industry for researching technologies and talking about the weaknesses of them. And if you remember, once that lawsuit was filed, the recording industry backed down immediately. They issued press statements saying, "We never meant to sue the professor, and if we did threaten him, we don't mean it now. We take it back. He can go ahead and publish." And the reason why the recording industry backed down immediately was because they knew they would lose that case if it actually got litigated. And so these are the kinds of fact scenarios that we're looking for and we'll be bringing in the future.
Well, Robin, let me ask you this. If it was Professor Felton up there in court instead of me, do you think we'd have a different outcome now?
Well, I don't know that I could say that it would be 100% different, but I think it would be somewhat different. I think Hollywood did a very good job of painting this case in the press as being the hackers against the copyright industry. And once you start off from that perspective, it's sort of result-oriented judging was how it looked to me. Like the courts had made up their mind in advance that you guys were the bad guys, and they just needed to figure out a legal maneuver to get there, to reach that conclusion. And you know, it's frustrating for me because, you know, I believe in the justice system, and I believe that, you know, the justice system is supposed to be blind, but since I've actually been working in it, I've realized that there's the same prejudices in the justice system as there are in other walks of life, and we need to overcome those and recognize those and bring the kinds of cases that are not going to be prejudiced against automatically because maybe the defendant has long hair or the wrong color skin or speaks Russian. Those kinds of defendants are automatically seen as guilty by courts and by the public. And so it's tough to say how things would have turned out differently if you had been, I don't know, had a little shorter hair maybe or less computer savvy.
I wore a sports jacket, okay? That's as far as I go.
Remember, Robin, I made him wear a tie.
Yeah, and you know, it was very difficult getting that tie on me, too. I had to have like two different people help me put that on.
You should have used the clip-on.
That was the whole difference, Robin.
Robin, I believe you were chastised by the judge for your appearance, too, weren't you?
That's right. The judge seemed far more interested in what I was wearing each day and how appropriate or inappropriate that was than the actual legal issues that he was being asked to decide. And that was something else that I was particularly frustrated by during the trial.
And it wasn't, you know, you weren't wearing anything that was offensive in any way. It was perfectly okay, acceptable, but I think he had his particular style that he wanted followed.
I think it was the color. I think Eric, perhaps you can correct me, but I think color in courtrooms seems to be looked down upon. It's frowned upon by attorneys and judges.
Well, it depends. Actually, the lead defense lawyer in the Arthur Anderson case, who was actually very successful in front of the jury, started out the first day wearing a bright red suit.
Wow.
But then again, that's Houston, Texas, and it's known for a rather flamboyant bar, just generally. But I think that your point of some clients, just because of accents or just because of being perceived as a hacker and having that label applied to them, or because of dress or economic standing or what have you, sometimes starting with a disability in front of courts that are sworn to deliver equal justice without regard to those things. And it's very frustrating sometimes when even the appearance of that happening occurs.
We're speaking with Eric Grimm, who led us to victory in the lawsuit that Ford filed against us, and that case is now over. And Robin Gross of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who helped us with the DECSS case, another case which is now over. And, well, we didn't win that one, but at least not in court we didn't win that one, but I feel like we won in the public eye. And certainly we brought a lot of different people together, and I think we come out stronger for that. Our phone number is 212-209-2900 if you'd like to ask any questions of these two people. Please give us a call. Any other remarks from you guys?
Yeah, while we're waiting for a call, I'd like to tee up an issue for Robin that I'm sure she'll like to talk about. But this is another very important copyright case that EFF is involved in now. And if Robin could tell us a little bit about the Sonic Blue case.
Oh,
that they've just filed in California.
I'd be happy to. This is the case over digital VCRs and the individual's right to be able to use a VCR in their home that has digital capabilities. Sonic Blue makes and distributes replay TV devices, very similar to TiVo. It's the same thing as a VCR, but it's a digital VCR. And last October, 28 of the largest entertainment corporations sued Replay TV and Sonic Blue for making and distributing these digital VCRs, and their claim is that they're tools of piracy.
Now, didn't the entertainment industry already lose that 20 years ago in the Sony case?
That's what we thought too. That's exactly what we thought when Hollywood tried to ban the importation of VCRs back in the early 80s, and the Supreme Court ruled against them and said, no, you can't outlaw VCRs just because they're capable of infringement. There's lots of non-infringing uses for this technology, and so you're going to have to you can't ban it, essentially. But this is a new, we're in a digital world now, and so it's a new opportunity to fight the same old battles. In fact, the CEO of Turner Broadcasting, a fellow by the name of Jamie Kellner, has been going around in the media and making claims that skipping over commercials is copyright infringement.
Yeah.
He's flat out called it stealing. And when a reporter asked him, well, what about individuals who have to go to the bathroom during the commercials? His quote, his response is, well, there's a certain amount of bathroom use that we're willing to tolerate. You know, so I mean, this really goes to show the arrogance of the industry that your attention really belongs to them, and you know, you're just supposed to sit there and watch whatever they put in front of you. Well, this really upset a lot of Replay TV customers, and what was really the nail in the coffin for us getting involved in this case was back in April when the recording industry asked for and received a discovery order from the magistrate judge requiring Replay TV to go back, rewrite its software to monitor the viewing habits of its customers and report that data to the recording industry for its litigation purposes. That really upset a lot of people, Replay TV owners and the general public. And so Replay TV objected to that. Several groups filed amicus briefs on the privacy issues of the Replay TV customers that would be in their privacy rights that would be invaded, and EFF signed on to an amicus brief on that issue. But this really outraged the customers, and we got in contact. We received some calls and emails from several and put together a case ourselves. We've got five Replay TV customers who we have actually brought an affirmative challenge, a declaratory judgment suit, where we have asked the court to now declare that these individuals are engaging in lawful activity when they use their digital VCRs to record programs and skip over commercials.
And isn't that exactly what the plaintiffs, the movie industry plaintiffs, don't want to happen, is have an actual direct fight with the people who they're trying to label as pirates and infringers?
Exactly. I mean, all of the cases that have been brought so far that the recording industry has been very successful in bringing have been brought against the technology companies. It's been a very effective way to step on the rights of the people who aren't even parties to these cases, the people who are the ones using this technology. And, you know, we want the actual users in on this case that, you know, the recording industry, Hollywood, is claiming that these folks are nothing but pirates, doing nothing but engaging in infringement. Well, let's take a look at what they're doing. Let's see what they're doing, and let's ask the court to rule on whether or not these activities are infringement. But that, again, that's not what Hollywood wants. They're fighting very hard to try to keep the customers out of this case.
It's a lot easier to fight, I'd think, if you have a faceless pirate there instead of actually having somebody there in the witness box. Who looks like a normal person like you and me and has a respectable job and uses these devices for completely legitimate reasons.
Absolutely. I mean, one of our five plaintiffs is a parent, and he likes to be able to control the amount of advertising that his children are exposed to in the evenings. And so he wants to be able to cut out some of those commercials, and that's his right as a parent to do that. But Hollywood's trying to say, no, actually, your child's attention belongs to us. You're not allowed to do that. And we feel like that is it's an encroachment on society's free speech rights. It's an encroachment upon this parent's right. It's the arrogance is overwhelming.
Well, I think that if we owe a debt of thanks, actually, to the recording industry and to the Hollywood industry, because, you know, if they had just kept quiet and not acted like themselves, then they might have had a chance of convincing most people that these laws and regulations are in their best interest. But no, they stepped forward and said all this nonsense and showed that their true motives are complete greed and basically capturing the attention of everybody at all costs. And I think most people see that now and they realize, you know, this is not what I want. This is not what I signed on for. And I think, you know, they deserve credit as one of the major forces in educating people, what we've been trying to do all this time. Their true motives, their true actions have really shined the light on a lot of people. We're speaking with Robin Gross and Eric Grimm, and both of you guys are going to be appearing on a panel at H2K2, the DMCA Legal Update, on Saturday, July 13th. I believe that's at 11 a.m., and Robin and I will be on the DCSS panel, which will be on Friday at 4 o'clock p.m. And we're taking phone calls now, 212-209-2900. So let's move over to our first listener phone call. Good evening. You're on the air. No, you're not. Okay. Let's go over here. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good.
I have a question. I'm reading about this new bill from this congressman in California, which would allow companies to go after peer-to-peer networks and attack them, basically, to prevent their copyrighted material from being downloaded. Do you guys know anything about that?
Yes, I have heard about that. I'm sure that Robin knows all about it, too, although we've been deprived of the opportunity actually to look at the language of what's being proposed. So far, there's only been a press release about it, as far as I know. Robin, do you know any more?
No, that's exactly right. The actual language hasn't been released. Representative Howard Berman from Southern California is the congressman who will be introducing this legislation, and all he's really said is that he wants to give copyright holders broad powers to be able to spoof computers, destroy individuals' computers' files if they decide that, basically give people, copyright holders, the right and the ability to search through your computers and decide whether or not you've got files on your computer that they feel are infringing, and the legal authority to just go ahead and destroy them right there on the spot.
The whole thing strikes me as just utterly remarkable, because the behavior that Howard Berman is trying to endorse is exactly the kind of terribly antisocial and destructive behavior that hackers have falsely been accused of for years and years and years. And all of a sudden we're saying that it's a wonderful thing for the recording industry and the motion picture industry to go ahead and do this on an industrial scale to people all over the country.
wouldn't it violate the cybercrime laws? I mean, it seems like we would violate the law.
But what they're trying to do is create a big loophole in the cybercrime laws, which is we're going to prosecute you to the fullest extent of the law if you're anybody except a motion picture company or a recording company, but they get free rein to go after people if they just have a suspicion that unauthorized copies of music or films happen to be on your computer. I assume that it would extend to books and literature also, but that remains to be seen in terms of what actually comes out in the bill. I'm getting echo here all of a sudden, Emmanuel.
Sorry, you might be on a Sprint phone. Are you on a Sprint phone?
No, I'm not.
Okay, well, you sound good now.
Okay,
all
thanks.
Right. Sorry about that.
Well, this bill would be right in line with another piece of legislation that was passed right after last year's 9/11 tragedy, when there was a real rush to pass security legislation and try to beef up America's so-called security. And the recording industry got an exemption in the law that was being passed that would shield them from criminal liability if they were going to destroy individuals' computer files wrongfully. They had originally asked to be given a blanket exemption, both criminal and civil. There was a little bit of a public backlash to this, and the way the legislation actually passed was they got criminal exemption, but if they actually destroy your property, you can still go ahead and sue them civilly. But there's not a whole lot of people that actually have the resources to sue the recording industry, so it's cold comfort to most folks.
Okay, let's take another phone call. Good evening. You're on the air.
Yes, I have a question and comment for the guests.
Make it quick.
Okay. Did you ever hear of a thing that when you go into certain restaurants, first of all, commercials are becoming longer now, and also in certain restaurants there's a little sign that say, due to copyright regulations, the volume on this TV cannot be turned up.
That's a good question. I don't know why I'm coming through the phone now. But can you answer that question?
Yeah. If you go into some business establishments, there are rules about playing the music for the public. If you're going to have the music at a certain volume, it will be considered a public performance, and a public performance royalty rates will apply, and you will be required to pay royalties to the recording industry, particularly ASCAP, BMI, for publicly performing sound recordings. And so that's the reason for that law.
Well, I know this caller called in before about this, and one of the reasons that had been given when someone else investigated it was that by keeping the volume on the TV off, it was forcing people to listen to the music that was being piped through, and that they had an exclusive contract that said that they were the only type of audio that could be heard in that establishment. Does that make any sense?
It's possible. I mean, that this particular establishment could have that kind of an agreement. Sure, sure. That's entirely possible.
Some pretty wacky agreements out there. Okay, let's take another phone call. Good evening. You're on the air.
Yes. Good evening. I heard you say something about freedom of speech, and I was denied my freedom of speech on this very station. I want to play some.
Yeah. You know, someone hung up on him 25 years ago, and we're never going to hear the end of it. Good evening. You're on the air.
Okay. Now, also, did you...
Do we have more than two listeners? It would be nice.
Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm appreciative of hearing the Electronic Freedom Foundation because I've been grateful for a lot of work that they've done. It seems normally they have the outlook that the free flow of information is good for everybody. So I'm a bit dismayed to hear that one of the arguments in the case is that parents should be able to control the amount of advertising their children are exposed to, because another way of saying that is parents should be able to control what information their children have access to. And if you put it as keeping them from seeing advertising, sounds fine. But then if you talk about parents of a gay teenager, for example, who might want their child not to get information about homosexuality off the internet, or parents of a particular religion want to keep information about evolution from their children, It seems that it's a pernicious legal principle, and I wonder if you considered that before you decided that that was one of the arguments you wanted to make.
Well, I think that these are really two very different situations. I mean, we're talking about parents who have very young children that they want to be able to not have them always saying, I want to buy this, I want to buy that, buy me one of these, buy me one of those. I think that's a reasonable thing for a parent to want to be able to control. And not only that, I mean, we're talking about the messages that are coming into your own home. And I think that a parent does have the right to control the kind of information that enters into their own home. Whether or not they, once the child is a little bit older and goes out and explores and finds information on their own, I mean, of course I think it's a totally different situation then, and a parent does not necessarily have the right to be able to prevent their children from having access to information about ideas that they disagree with. But it's a slippery slope, and it is very much dependent upon the age of the child and the kinds of measures that the parent goes to try to control. Some level of a control is appropriate, and some level of control is clearly inappropriate. So it's really a slippery slope.
I couldn't agree more, Robin. I mean, this is really an age-dependent issue. And just like infants and toddlers are very much dependent on their parents, they also have to rely on their parents in an interactive way to help guide them in terms of getting used to their information environment. And unlimited access to commercial advertising, basically putting control over how our children are raised in the hands of advertisers as opposed to parents, strikes me as deeply problematic. That is absolutely not the same thing as saying that the parents get to micromanage everything that a teenager gets to do. I mean, look, you don't let your toddler go out and run out in the streets, but you do trust your teenager.
I wouldn't let my teenager to walk
to school independently, and you don't have as much control. It's just a natural thing in most families for the level of independence of a child to increase as the child gets older.
Yeah, I think it's a natural thing in most families, but when you make a legal argument that rests on the presumption that parents have the right to control what information their children have access to, I don't know that the law is as subtle as the examples that you're bringing up. You said, for example, well, if it's in your home, the parents have the right to control it. Unfortunately, courts have ruled that children up till the age of 18 do not have the right to leave their home and move out without their parents' consent. So when you say, well, if it's in your parents' home, they get control, then the law is saying you have to stay in that home. And if, for example, you're a gay teenager and your parents don't want you to have access to information about homosexuality or support groups for gay teens, then that's their right as a parent. So you have to be really, really careful when you look at these issues.
Right.
But the legal issue for why it's really not a legal issue. The legal issue is copyright infringement. The legal issue is whether or not you have the right to skip over commercials. And because one of the reasons why somebody might want to do it is to control the amount of advertising, doesn't necessarily mean that that's the precedent that gets set. The precedent that gets set is it is not copyright infringement to skip over commercials.
I wonder why you would choose that particular example, one of the arguments you want to make, to show why that's important.
Good example that shows how much control Hollywood feels it has over the whole individual's attention and the individual's own private life, where that control more properly belongs with the family and in the home. And we can argue about what level of authority is appropriate in the home, but we can all agree that it is not appropriate for it to be in Hollywood.
Okay, we're going to have to move on, but thanks for the question.
Okay, thank you.
Good question there. Thank you. Okay, that's just not a right kind of a noise for the phone to be making. This phone has really been annoying me all night. Is everybody still okay?
Yes.
Okay, you there, Robin?
You got it.
All right, sorry about that. Let's take another phone call. Let's go over here. Good evening. You're on the air.
Yes, commercials lately have been...
Do you really think you're fooling anyone with that voice? Good evening. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello, I'm wondering how he gets on so easily.
He runs a phone company, I think. I don't know.
I suspect that.
Yeah. What's on your mind?
My question, it might be a little far-fetched because I'm totally ignorant when it comes to computers. Can you tell me anything about fiber optic cable? Would that in any way infringe or affect my reception on my TV or interfere in any way with the energy level or whatever fiber optic does?
Okay.
Honestly, I'm
the
lawyer,
reason I
asked
that question, I noticed Con Edison about a week ago Friday was doing a job on the corner of 9th Avenue and 50th Street over here in Hell's Kitchen, and they were putting in some fiber optic cable beneath the street level.
Okay, we're going to try to answer this.
I have to modify and say maybe it is a far-fetched question with your program.
Well, on BAI, there's no such thing as a far-fetched question. So we'll try to answer your question on the radio. And Robin, Eric, is there any answer that you might be able to fathom?
Actually, one of the technology people that you have there in your studio may be able to answer it better than I can.
Jim, you're making all kinds of motions here.
Well, the first thought is, yes, it is far-fetched. But then I thought about that and said, it's not, but not for the reasons that you think. The fiber optic transmission itself is not going to interfere with your electromagnetic apparatus of any sort. But keep in mind that it has to go somewhere after it stops being fiber optic. It has to be converted back into copper wires to get to your phone. So it's possible that they screwed up the interface in some way. They're doing drilling, so maybe they hit a cable for your, I don't know what's acting up, television, I'll assume. They hit a cable for your TV. They're running big electrical equipment right outside. That tends to have all sorts of resonance effects on electromagnetic implements and appliances. The possibilities are endless. It's not the fiber optics per se. It's that they're screwing around in the street digging it up.
We could spend all night talking about this, but we're not going to because we're out of time. I want to thank Eric Grimm and Robin Gross for joining us and invite everybody to join us at the H2K2 conference coming up on, not this weekend coming up, but the next weekend, starting very early on Friday and running until very late on Sunday. That's July 12th through 14th. It's called H2K2. It takes place at the Hotel Pennsylvania, 32nd Street and 7th Avenue. More information, www.h2k2.net. Robin, Eric, any last words from you?
I have one thing, which is that tomorrow is July the 4th, and I would encourage everybody to read first the Declaration of Independence and second the Bill of Rights, just to remind ourselves of exactly what the rights are, the individual rights that this country is built on, and those happen to be exactly the rights that are under assault right now in Congress, in the executive of the federal government, and in a lot of other places. And this is a good time to remind ourselves of what this country is all about.
Okay, Robin, quickly.
Yeah, I can't agree with that more. It seems to me, from what I've been seeing, the actions coming out of Congress and particularly the White House and the Attorney General's offices, these folks can't shred the Constitution fast enough. And this war on democracy, I find to be particularly offensive, and it just strikes me so horribly that we're doing it all under the guise of freedom and under the guise of promoting democracy when it just seems like we are trying to colonize the world. So I share Eric's concern for the world right now.
Okay. Well, thanks very much to both of you for joining us. And, of course, we encourage people to visit www.eff.org. And make a donation to help them fight cases like what we've been through over the last couple of years and keep it going. This is Emmanuel Goldstein. For everybody else, have a good night. We'll see you next week. Good night.
Mother was an incubator. Father was the contents of a test tube in the icebox in the factory of birth. My name is 905.
This Thursday, July 4th, join hundreds in a liberation demonstration for freedom from Mumia Abu-Jamal and against U.S. oppression worldwide. 10 a.m. Philadelphia City Hall, 15th and Market Streets, then march to the Liberty Bell at 5th and Market for a freedom rally. 20 years on death row and still no justice. That's Thursday, July 4th, 10 a.m., the west side of City Hall, 15th and Market Streets in Philadelphia.
Break the chains that bind us. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
For buses and information, please call the Free Mumia Abu-Jamal Coalition at 212-330-8029. Let's free Mumia.